Oh, hi, LTS listeners. It's Shelley here. In the upcoming show, you'll hear me refer to episode 46 of Lions, Towers, and Shields. At the time of recording, I honestly thought it was episode 46. Then Joseph Cotton burst into my home and forced me to update my RSS feed to episode 47. Thank you, Joseph Cotton. Does something sound weird to you? Me neither. Shields from the Incomparable Network. This is episode 46, and I am your host, Shelley Brisbane. Welcome to a discussion of classic films. Or is it? Tonight we're talking about Gaslight from 1944, directed by George Cukor, starring Charles Boyer, Ingrid Bergman, Joseph Cotton, and some busybodies, and Angela Lansbury. But I can't talk about Gaslight alone. I need some loyal, intrepid panelists to do that with me, and they are here. First up, it's Annette Wierster. Hi.
Hi. I placed my mic around here somewhere, but I can't seem to remember where I put it. Oh,
Annette, you're always losing things. I'm worried about you. I'm worried.
You
Erica Ensign, perhaps you can help Annette find her things since you're relatively near her in space. Hi.
Well, actually, Shelley, I'm a little concerned because I have been here for an hour. You told me an hour ago, and I'm a little concerned that you're forgetting the time that we are supposed to start these podcasts.
Well, I did lose my watch recently, so... And last but not least, a representative of the patriarchy, it's Nathan Alderman.
Oh, I'm doomed. I'm very excited to talk about this movie in which Pepe Le Pew psychologically tortures a woman for 2 hours.
Pola. I had to get out of the way. All right, we're done. yes. So if, because you can't not have, if the term gaslight has come to your ear and eyeballs in the last few years, this is the source of it. The movie Gaslight from 1944 is based on a play, which then begat an English film called Gaslight that MGM attempted to literally destroy and murder, but was somewhat unsuccessful in doing so because there's like one print left that the director made. But this is the far better known version. It was nominated for Best Picture. Ingrid Bergman wins Best Actress. It is the film debut of Angela Lansbury. All sorts of interesting stuff going on here. And one of my favorite directors, George Cukor, did this movie. But let me ask each of you to tell me what your experience with Gaslight, not the concept, but the movie, was. Nathan, is this another one that I convinced you to watch that you'd never seen before?
Yes, I'd heard about it a lot, but I'd never actually seen it. You know, it's pretty famous, obviously, and has only, unfortunately, become more famous in the last 4 or 5 years. You know, when you think noir lighting, you don't think George Cukor, but this was a really impressive movie. I enjoyed it a lot. It's a weird movie. It's got some interesting flaws that I can't wait to discuss. But man, ultimately, it is a satisfying movie.
I'm feeling good about this because every once in a while I bring a movie in here and I think we're going to have a lot of fun because it's a movie I like, and then it gets crapped on all over the place. So far, so good. Erica, how do you feel about Gaslight?
I also had never seen it. I knew of its existence for, you know, quite a few years, simply because I had come across the term gaslighting in, you know, society.
In the world.
And yeah. And it's interesting because quite often when a meme or a term comes out of something that's really, really old, there is only a tenuous connection between the original and what it has become, because it just iterates and things change a lot. So I went into this movie just thinking, okay, probably there's going to be, you know, he says a couple of things and they're not true, whatever. I just didn't expect this movie to be the epitome of what gaslighting is. There's like, there are very few cases of a modern term or a modern meme where you can say, go look back at the original, and that original gives you exactly what it is. It's the perfect definition. That is what this film is. And it was also actually an excellent film. So hurrah, hurrah.
And in fact, whenever I hear gaslighting used in the modern vernacular, I always think, oh, you don't even know. Because things that are gaslighting adjacent are called gaslighting, but I don't know. I think back to, because I saw this movie long before I heard the term in modern usage, and so I always think, yeah, but Charles Boyer isn't, you know, about to murder you and put you in the madhouse, whatever. Not to diminish any actual gaslighting that has happened to people. I just think terminology gets thrown around in a fairly haphazard way sometimes. So Annette, romance movies, you love those, right?
I do. And I feel like the tables have all turned because I've seen this movie before. And everyone else, excellent. Like you have all these people.
Wow.
I'm usually the one who's never seen it. So I watched it when the term started to come to the fore quite a while ago. And I watched it because of that. Also because I heard Angela Lansbury was in it, and I love Angela, and she does not disappoint in this movie. I hadn't seen it in a while though. And like Erica, I was like, if this movie wasn't the origin of the term gaslight, you would be like, it's so on the money. It's almost would be a caricature of gaslighting because you're just like, oh yeah. Like, oh, and it made me so anxious all over again because he's just so good at it.
Same. And I've seen this several times, but it did make me anxious. It always makes me really uncomfortable to watch this movie. And I just like, I really find myself wanting to come to Ingrid's defense and just say, get out of the way. I'm going to. And as somebody, I read several reviews and articles about this movie. And as somebody points out, there's several women in the film who could theoretically be of help to Ingrid Bergman. But we have to wait for Joseph Cotten, the man, to ride in at the end. So there's a whole lot of patriarchy in different ways going on in this movie.
Well, yeah, that's interesting because in one way, like society works against her. When she gets upset at the dinner party, the hostess is a friend and is obviously concerned. But, you know, she's not going to be rude and like barge in on this marriage between a husband and his wife. And, you know, the neighbor, Mae Whitty, she could be a help, but she's really so self-absorbed that she's only kind of interested in this for her own voyeuristic glee. And, you know, the cook, they take pains to say the cook is deaf. So she, you know, she's sympathetic and she is really helpful, but she just doesn't hear the same things that Ingrid Bergman does. And so she's not in a position to recognize or understand them. And then there's Angela Lansbury, and man, that's a whole other deal.
who Charles Boyer has subverted, but who is entirely willing to be subverted. So,
yeah, I don't even think that he subverts her. I think she was verted on her own.
She comes in pre-verted.
Pre-verted, yes.
She was never going to be the sympathetic type. If there's not something specifically in it for her, she would not have. And Boyer was wise to sort of, you know, he the things he does in this movie to make Ingrid Bergman go nuts are so clever in the sense that he can accomplish two things in one. So he can get Angela Lansbury, quote, on his side, not that she's a fan of his, but that she realized that's where her bread is buttered. But by doing that, he also makes his wife insecure as a woman. And it's just like everything he does has just multiple impacts. And even and in my opinion, so he's up. When he's in the attic looking around for the jewels and the gaslight goes down and the banging on the floor because the footsteps on the floor, he knows that's happening, but that's just a consequence of something he's doing. He's not saying, well, this is part of my attempt to gaslight Ingrid Bergman because he's doing plenty of other things to her. Mm-hmm. But this also works to his advantage. It's like he's very lucky throughout this whole movie.
It's gravy.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's another version of this movie where, like, he and Angela Lansbury have an affair and he brings her into his confidence and she's a willing accomplice rather than just, like, her, like, throwing bedroom eyes at him and him being weirdly uninterested. Her character, I mean, okay, I love Angela Lansbury in this movie, you guys. You ever seen footage of like a plane landing on an aircraft carrier where like its landing gear is out and it like has to smash onto the deck and barely, you know, gets caught by the tail hooks and barely avoids going off the edge of the carrier? That's Angela Lansbury coming into this movie. She is coming in hot in every sense of the word. And then there's moments where she opens her mouth and that voice comes out and I'm just like, I guess Jessica Fletcher is sexy now. I'm going to have to sit with that for a while.
Look, I'm going to tell you, Jessica Fletcher is sexy if you watch it. I'm like, you know, watching it as a woman who is like an you know, mature instead of as a teenager, I'm like, oh, she's way hotter than you think when you watched it back in the day. But also, I think I love her because she also is playing all of the cops out on the street. She has like all these men in play. So she's not just like making eyes at him. She's making eyes at all the boys and trying to like, she's got her plan and her ambition, I think, to marry up or find security or just have a good time. It could be all of the above. And she's doing it all. And I sort of am rooting for her, even though she is not an ally to Paula.
Well, I had forgotten details like this, but when Joseph Cotton gets his cop to go and take the position out in front of the house to sort of keep an eye on things, Angela Lansbury has already been Nancy is her character name. Nancy has already been having a relationship with the previous cop on the beat. And so, again, in a fortunate for this time for Joseph Cotton's side, that's fortunate because that means that Williams, the cop that he puts on the beat, is in a position to do the exact same thing. And for a little bit, I was like, wait, did Angela Lansbury just seduce him, or did Joseph Cotton know that he should get information from Angela Lansbury? And we find out later on that it was intentional. But I just love it because you're not sure whose motives are, you know, why things are happening. It's very off-putting in many ways.
This really is a deeply uncomfortable movie to sit through. I just, you know, we talked about with Blonde Venus how I squirmed at all the scenes of child endangerment, and this was like that too. It is really unpleasant to watch Ingrid Bergman suffering because she's so good at playing it. But I think if it weren't so horrible to sit through and just so like you want to crawl out of your skin for most of the movie, the ending would not be nearly the cathartic release that it is.
100%. And she, we can get to the ending in a bit, but she, it's such a payoff. And it's earned as an audience. You're just like, yes. And for a minute, you're worried that's not going to happen. But I guess I don't want to do plot, but just for people who might be catching up, if they've waited this long, well, they're probably, you know, they probably know this show. Anyway, so basically, Ingrid Bergman as a child, she was living with her aunt who was murdered in a house, and she was sent away to Italy to become an opera singer like her aunt had been. And she meets up, not accidentally, with this guy played by Charles Boyer, who then whisks her, who's considerably older than her. Let's do the age check. Let's see. There's 18 years difference in their ages. And he whisks her away and marries her. And through a set of weird circumstances, they end up living back at the house where this murder happened, which, oh, by the way, is still not only in Paula's name, but it is completely furnished. And, you know, I presume they dusted, but everything is just as it was 10 long years ago.
It's also important to mention that she looks very much like her aunt.
Yes, you're
right. And even had tried to pursue a singing career. Like, she's singing at the beginning of the film and, you know, recognizing that that's not the thing that's for her, even though her aunt was a really great singer. Because I do think that it's never super, super clear, but I do think that in the past, you know, the Charles Boyer character, like, the reason we know in the end that he murdered her aunt is because, like, he wanted the jewels. But I think he was also fascinated with her as well. And I think part of the reason that he finds it probably so easy to horn in on the niece that looks exactly like her is that fascination still exists there. So it's really easy for him to play up the, oh, I'm so in love with you, and then manipulate her very skillfully into having her be the one who suggests that they live in the same house that all of this happened before, because she is the one. And like, that's a master gaslighting technique, to be able to plant the seeds, to be able to make the victim think that, you know, they are the one that is suggesting this. And no, I insist, even though it was something that he wanted all along and is not actually good for her. And it's very clear it's not going to be good for her from moment one.
And this is a house where a tragic thing that she remembers, because she was 14 when she left the house, has occurred. This is not a house that otherwise she would choose to live in.
No, she found the body
right
in this house.
She and he had strangled her. She found the body, which is why he didn't get the jewels, because he has to run away. So the jewels are in her house somewhere, and he doesn't know where they are. And that's why he wants to go back so he can locate the jewels, because, again, nothing has been disturbed in 10 years.
I also love the opening with him being such the romantic hero. And there's like such a sidestep where this is a romantic movie instead of a noir, where everything's okay and she's just swept off her feet and how beautiful is that? And but it's just so like that's the master manipulator where you can you come in so romantic, so grand, so and just, you know, you want to marry him immediately and do whatever he suggests, even if it's you don't even realize he's done it. And then it turns so quickly, like as soon as they walk into that house, he starts isolating her. But before that, he is like the perfect husband, the perfect lover, the perfect ideal. Right. And so you because you know it's going to be this type of movie, you can see the signs in it coming. But it's like until he get into London, into that house, if you didn't know better, you can see why she falls in love with him.
Yeah, it's classic grooming material. Mm-hmm. Like he is like, you know, he is an abuser and he knows what he's doing and he is grooming her to create this foundation where she believes that he is wonderful and that he loves her and that he just wants to make her happy and that they're going to have this wonderful life. So she's got that foundation, like it is already planted deep in her psyche. And then, yes, they have gotten married. So, you know, the law basically says that he's in charge of her, which, you know, is not, you know, that's not a thing that's stated outright, but it's just because it's so understood in the culture that they are at this time, you know, they're married. So he's the one that has the power, even though the house was hers and all of that stuff was hers. It doesn't really matter because he's the one that people are going to listen to. And she knows he's the one that people are going to listen to. So even as she is slowly, like, you know, becoming to doubt herself more and more, she never really tries to turn to anybody else very early on, in part, I think, because she knows that you know, if she was on her own, maybe she would have a chance of having somebody else believe her. But no, there's this, you know, he is an even bigger impediment than he would have been. Were they just dating or something?
And the concert is the point where I realize that. I mean, you know it intuitively, but then you think about it and you say, well, what are her options? And as someone said, right, she's not going to be the person who is holding the concert is not going to be able to, you know, swoop in and rescue her. And even if she were able to provide her some temporary respite, Charles Boyer holds all the cards, basically. And whether or not he is going to go through with putting her in a madhouse, which he absolutely could do, he can control her in any number of ways, and she really has very little recourse.
It's interesting to me that he waits so long to take that step, because he could have, you know, pushed it up and really just worked to have her committed a lot quicker. Which is part of the reason that I think that he is still somewhat infatuated with, you know, the memory of her aunt and is somewhat infatuated with her. He likes having her. He likes owning her as a thing. And if he were to lock her up in a sanitarium somewhere, he wouldn't necessarily have that sense of ownership over her anymore. And the only time where he actually starts making moves toward that is when she starts to sort of break out of his, you know, he realizes that she's starting to trust herself a little bit. And that's not good for his circumstances. So he's the only time that he actually starts to take those steps toward having her locked up is when he thinks he might be losing control. Up until that point, she's just basically another pretty bauble that he's got to work
with. Yeah, I think it's that he was obsessed with her aunt, and her aunt had the power in that relationship. And so now he's like exacting his revenge because he is obsessed with her, but he's also really cruel to her. Like, he doesn't seem to be interested in, like, showing affection to her or having sex with her or any of that stuff. There's like a sneering, cold contempt in how he treats her. Yeah, man, he's so horrible. He couldn't even let her have one nice time at the concert. Like, what harm would that have done to his plans? Nope. But no, he's got to ruin that for her too.
Yeah, because it isn't all that important that other people see that she's gone crazy, because he doesn't really want her to go out at all. His plan all along has been to get enough evidence that she's crazy that can be committed. She can be committed, but that can be done with servants and with doctors that he pays. He doesn't have to take her out. So he takes her out because she essentially forces the issue, and then he pulls another stunt right in the middle of it, and she is more embarrassed than she's been throughout the entire movie. And you're right. There's an incredible amount of sadism, because you know, never mind that if somebody is exhibiting signs of mental instability or they're forgetful or whatever it might be, you know, the normal person would say, well, let's get you some help. But it's not only that he doesn't do that. He is angry with her. And he's just like, I hope to find you better in the morning. And he slams the door and runs away. So not only is she thrown off balance and just in terms of, am I losing my mind, but there's no comfort there at all. And he goes far beyond what he actually has to do to accomplish his goals.
He acts as if it's that she is doing this to him. It's an affront to him that, you know, I married you thinking you were this wonderful person. And it turns out you're a forgetful kleptomaniac who might be going insane. Whereas it's actually the complete opposite. She thought he was this wonderful person. And it turns out he's like just a sadistic, you know, sociopath or possibly psychopath. I mean, it's like he's bad news, but he has completely flipped it. Like, I have to say, if you are listening to this podcast and you have not watched this movie, if you have been in a relationship that sounds even remotely like this, huge red flag content warning for this movie. I have never been in a situation like that, and I'm very happy not to have. And I still found this movie very difficult to watch, in part because I do know people who have gone through things like this. And if it's something that you have dealt with, I can't imagine how awful and triggering this movie would be. So, you know, huge word of warning there, because it is
fast
effective.
Forward to when you see Charles Boyer in a chair. That part, from that part on, you'll be okay.
I found that scene, though, like the concert scene, like it gave me this like moment of hope that she was going to do something for herself, and that like her standing up and demanding to go to this concert and then also putting her into the path of I can't remember his character's name.
Joseph Cotton.
I just call him Joseph Cotton.
Yeah.
But when he, like, it puts her in his path and he's been trying to access her and you're just like, are they going to, like, connect? And then they'll start, like, doing something to get her out of this situation or she'll realize what's happening. And it seems like, you know, you have that moment of hope and then it switches and it, like, breaks your heart all over again. And ramps up the tension because it's like, oh, now she's never going to get another opportunity like this again. And I found it very effective.
Most of the scenes in the movie are in the house, which is quite dark. It's an old dark house, quite literally. And then the concert, she's wearing a beautiful light dress. The women are, the lighting is very bright. And it's, so you're coming literally into the light. And this is hopeful. This is not only is it hopeful because she might be rescued or she might find a way out herself. But as I say, the way she starts out to go to that concert is that she comes down the stairs dressed. And Charles Boyer has circumvented her getting the invitation. She's gotten the invitation, but he sent a note sending their regrets. And she said, I know about the invitation. I'm going. I'd love it if you'd go with me, but I'm going. And he's like, you're going by yourself. And then he rethinks it. And he says, all right, I'll go with you. And they go, and he finds a way to ruin her evening.
Mm-hmm. I don't think he so much rethinks it as I think he at first thinks that if he says you're going to have to go alone, he assumes she's going to capitulate and be like, OK, well, then I'm not going to go then. And when she actually like stands up for herself and says, no, I am going to go. Yeah, it's not rethinking it. It's more like,
you're right.
Oh, crap. I need to be there to make sure that she doesn't make a connection with somebody outside of this house.
Right.
So while she, yes, she's not the one that is able to really save herself in the end, I do think that this moment of her rallying a little bit and standing up for herself just that little bit, if not for her making it out to be seen by Joseph Cotton, then maybe none of the rest of the good things at the end of the movie would have actually come together. So while she doesn't exactly rescue herself, I do give her some credit for the fact that she gets rescued in the end.
I guess it makes sense that if she had been able to go out by herself, it would have boosted her confidence, and he needs her destroyed in order to keep her in the palm of his hand. But speaking of Joseph Cotton, in another sense, this is a movie about a guy who becomes obsessed with a married woman, starts stalking her, and then abusing his power as a police officer to keep her under constant surveillance. And he's the good guy, folks.
Right. True enough. Well, I it's there's so many movies. I read an article that I will link to because it's really good and really thoughtful that talks about this movie as a part of a cycle in 40s movies of women not being able to trust their husbands. And it starts with the Hitchcock movies, with Rebecca and with Suspicion. And then we go to Jane Eyre and we go to Laura and we go to a couple of more. Oh, Sorry, Wrong Number. And there are a whole lot of movies where the house, the home, is the sanctuary. It's where women in particular find comfort and strength, whether it's through social encounters or whether it's through making a home. And there are all these movies with terrible men who make the home a place of torture. And in most of the movies, but they exclude Gaslight from this, most of the movies that they talk about in this cycle, the husband isn't even necessarily sexually attracted to, or the husband or the man at the center of the movie, shall we say, isn't even sexually attracted to the woman, as in Laura with Clifton Webb, who is a coded gay man, or in Rebecca, I would argue. I don't think Laurence Olivier is particularly thinking a lot about Joan Fontaine's character when they get together. And in Sorry, Wrong Number, where you barely even see the husband who's scamming Barbara Stanwyck. And the Charles Boyer is kind of the exception in that I agree with Erica that I think he does have some attraction for Bergman and the fascination with her because she looks like her aunt. The other thing that Charles Boyer is really attracted to are diamonds. Mm. And there's that scene where he's like in lust for jewels and it's like, ooh, this is...
But the crown jewels. Well, first of all, I've been to see the crown jewels and I'm thinking, you know what, this movie, you could not remake that scene today, because now when you go to look at the crown jewels, you literally stand on basically a people mover, one of those walkways right. That's just moving, and it takes you past because they don't want you to linger and like stare. And like, I'm just like picturing Charles Boyer's head just sort of like on a swivel, like as he goes past. And it's like, it's not as effective
he's
modern
pressed up
way.
Against the glass and like sliding across it. Squee!
I love it.
Well, but the funny thing is that scene starts because they're in the Tower of London and they're seeing all of the devices by which monarchs were beheaded, and you think that's as bad as it's going to get, and then he's just trying to make Ingrid Bergman uncomfortable. He says, come on, we have to go see the crown jewels, which sounds like, oh, that's probably something nice and diverting. And then they get to the crown jewels and he's like steaming up the glass over here.
So creepy.
Much like Pepe Le Pew, you guys. The voice, the way that, I mean, this is a black and white movie, but the way he's always dressed in like shades of black and white, and then his like hair is slicked up in that pompadour, it gets real disturbing real fast.
I do have to give some props to the lighting director, I guess, and the director. Just the way that they made the diamonds like sparkle, or it's not even a sparkle, it's like they're glowing and shining from within, I think is a very nice touch, because that really helped bring it home how important that was. I don't think I would have gotten what I needed to out of that scene with the crown jewels if there wouldn't have been that reflection, like specifically on that, you know, that jewel, because, you know, yeah, his little speech about it, but the fact that it, you know, glowed from within, and then we see that happen again later when he actually does find the jewels. I just thought that was a wonderful visual touch in a way that's like, that's not a thing that I had seen in any other movies from this period.
And you kind of need it, and it's hard to do in black and white.
Yes.
This is interesting because the cinematographer previously worked with Fritz Lang on Manhunt and Fury. So yeah, I was about to say, you know, I was wondering how he'd gotten this, because he also did the Philadelphia Story. But if you've seen Fury or Manhunt, you know that, you know, that they've got some really great, creepy, stark lighting in them, especially Fury. And you can see, I love the brief moment when Paula is looking at the fireplace, remembering the moment of her aunt's death, and suddenly the whole lighting in the room changes, and there's this weird, eerie light coming up from behind the couch in front of the fireplace, as if you're seeing her memory of that night.
Yeah, and I think we were having a discussion before we got on the mics, or actually several days ago, about how unusual a movie this was for Cukor, just in terms of the darkness. And I think there are some people who believe that if Cukor has a masterpiece, this is it. And I mentioned there are a few other movies that he did that have either dark themes or sort of dark cinematography, but absolutely not known for that. This is the man who did the director who did the Philadelphia Story and Adam's Rib and My Fair Lady and that sort of thing. So he wasn't really known for this sort of thing. And I don't know, it may not have been his preference, But he did a great job, and it's very, very Hitchcock-like without some of the baggage that I think you get sometimes in Hitchcock. Although I will say that I like Hitchcock of this period. Once you get past, you know, Rope or so, I'm a little bit out on Hitchcock, but Hitchcock or Cukor in the 40s doing scary dark stuff, I like.
Well, that was interesting to me because this movie, it's uncomfortable to watch, but it's not really suspenseful in the way that Hitchcock is, where there are set pieces where someone is trying to accomplish something or not get caught, and you're like, oh, are they going to do it? Are they going to make it? What it emphasizes instead is the psychology, how people are feeling, what's going on inside their heads, and that makes it interesting and compelling. It doesn't have that crackerjack feel that Hitchcock's movies do, but I thought it was really interesting. And I think maybe for this story, a less superficial and more interior take is the better way to go.
Yeah, Hitchcock famously was not as interested in people. I mean, he certainly got into the dark side of people and why they did things, but it was much more from a cynical point of view. And Cukor doesn't do that. And Cukor is a director who famously has affinity for actresses. And I think the writing, I think, is really good, too. I don't know who did the adaptation. I don't have it in front of me. But I think that's one of the strongest elements of it, that and the pacing, because the length of time, and it's quite a long movie for this era, it's like an hour and 54 minutes, and the length of time it takes this all to play out, and the reason it's so uncomfortable is because of how long it takes and because of how intricate the things that Boyer is doing to her are. And a lot of that is accomplished through the script, I think. Shall we talk about the ending?
Yes. Well, before we get to the ending, there are some structural oddities in this film. Joseph Cotten's character does not interact with Ingrid Bergman until like the last 20 minutes of the movie.
That's right.
It's really weird. He like sees her once, and then the rest of the movie, he is pursuing a parallel track that is completely separate from hers until they finally come together at the end. Structurally, that really struck me as odd. And also Angela Lansbury's character, when she's introduced in the movie, especially in that dress and giving that performance, you think she's going to be a bigger presence in the movie than she is. And I feel like she's almost wasted in this film, which is a shame because Bergman's giving a performance, but Angela Lansbury is being a movie star in this movie.
Angela just sort of disappears at some point. Like, there's no point that it makes sense that she's gone, but she...
The version that I watched had a little coda at the end with some talking head talking about it, saying that Angela Lansbury started out the film knocking it out of the park so much that they actually increased her role. She was supposed to have even less to do in this film, but because she was so vibrant and vivacious, they wrote it up a bit more. So, yeah, she doesn't have a ton to do, but she has way more to do than she would have otherwise. So it really is to her own credit as an actor that she got as much to do as she ended up doing. And then the other thing that you mentioned, Nathan, which is I found interesting, is you mentioned Joseph Cotten's character sort of on a parallel track. And the funny thing is his track is actually parallel to Charles Boyer's, because they both had a fascination with Paula's aunt. It was a very different kind of fascination. You know, he was a good kid and was just a really big fan and, you know, had a glove that was signed.
I thought that was sweet.
And which is super sweet. And then he sees Paula, who looks so much like her aunt, who is this person that he was, you know, a huge, huge fan of and fascinated with. That, like, it absolutely makes sense that he would see her, you know, across the street or whatever and recognize her and think, oh, wow, this is weird. What's going on? Because, you know, he's a cop. He knows the history of it. And this is... It's got to seem strange to anybody looking in who knows the details why would you be moving back into this house? This just doesn't make any sense. So his cop, you know, his spidey senses as a cop tingles, and that, like, that puts him on that track. But it is really a reflection of, you know, our quote unquote good guy and our definitely bad guy are mirror images of each other in a way, mm-hmm. in terms of how they interacted with both the aunt and the niece.
I'd say, too, like, just like in a different story, you could have Boyer as the romantic hero. It could be just as easily that Cotten is the stalker as Nathan brought up earlier, because there's not like a ton of reason for him to become so fascinated, right? Other than the backstory they kind of tell you over time. But it's like all of a sudden he's like super focused on her. And like, there's not really from the outside a lot of signifier that there's anything going wrong, other than you don't see them a lot. As someone who barely leaves the house, you know, maybe I'm being gaslit too, but, you know, but it's like, why is he so fascinating? And eventually we get more of that story, but it's like, it is so close that easily you can easily, like, the villain and the hero are so just a couple sidesteps different, and they could easily swap places. So,
well, and yeah. His bona fides when he finally meets her, and he's got that one scene to convince her that he's going to help her. He's got the glove and he has the connection to her aunt, but that's no more or less than Charles Boyer had, right? So he doesn't know, she doesn't know that Charles Boyer knew her aunt, but I'm certain, even though we don't really see their courtship, that the way he ingratiated himself to her would similarly be charming and being, you know, you can trust me and I know you've had a difficult life and so on. And I'm the one that can save you or whatever it is. Because Cotton has very little time to convince her that he's on her side. And because she's been gaslit the entire movie, she could be forgiven for going, I don't know you. Mm. Who are you?
But on the other hand,
perhaps why are you looking at that?
Why do you have that
her.
Picture of my aunt in your pocket?
Yes, yes. But I think it's a testament to her that deep down she actually does know that something's off.
Sure.
But you know, it's hard to fight against it all the time. But when that door opens and she's like, "I knew that I wasn't forgetting things and that these things were off and I was seeing the light," you know, it just sort of confirms what she was feeling. But she had no one to sort of take her side on this. And when you have both Nancy and her husband sort of undercutting her, it becomes harder and harder. But I think it's a testament to her that she is like, "I knew it," and kind of jumps right in there, right?
Does anybody want to walk us through our ending?
So one of the things I loved about the ending was that this is a movie where you get to see a woman's life get saved just because someone listens to her and believes her. I've never been gaslit. I've never been in a gaslighty type relationship, and I hope to God I've never gaslit anyone else. So for me, watching this movie, it was like, oh man, this isn't a recent phenomenon. No, this has been around for a long time. I just kept thinking of all the horrible people in very recent years who appear to have used this movie as a how-to manual. So Joseph Cotton comes to the house. He manages to win Ingrid Bergman's trust by showing her the missing glove she mentions earlier. This movie is not hard to figure out, y'all. You will twig to almost the exact plot within the first 20 minutes. But he shows her the missing glove that she'd mentioned earlier that belonged to her aunt, and explains how she gave it to him when he was a young boy admiring her. And then he listens to her and he believes her. And my God, the relief that washes over her is shared by the audience. So they fix up a plan to stop Charles Boyer. They get the maid, the cook involved. She's a nice lady, but like we mentioned, she's deaf. So the script is set up that she is not always in a position to help Ingrid Bergman. But when he says, your friend is in trouble, she's like, I'm ride or die. I will go to the mat for Ingrid Bergman, which is a nice moment. Boyer comes back unexpectedly. He's found the jewels at last, and he's very upset. And he manages to trick it out of her that there was a man in the house. And the cook actually saves her life by saying, "No, there was no man here." At the cost of making her doubt herself all over again, the cook blows suspicion off her and gets Charles Boyer to calm down, whereas otherwise he might have killed her. And then Joseph Cotton manages to come back, gets the drop on Boyer. They fight. They wrestle. He beats Boyer up and ties him up in a chair. And then Ingrid Bergman gets to take her power back and read him for filth. And it is amazing.
Oh. She's so good.
Because she mocks him. She plays with him. She uses everything that he used against her against him. He's like, no, I'm sorry. You're awesome. I really do love you. How about you get that knife and cut these ropes and untie me? And she's like, oh, this knife? This knife over here? And for a moment, you're like, stab him, Ingrid Bergman. Stab him so many times. But she does something even better. She's like, no, there isn't a knife in my hand. How could there be a knife in my hand? Oh, there is.
I always misplace
things. Yes, she flings it aside and says, oh, I'm always losing things. It's amazing. Oh, my gosh. And then she gets to be the one to call in Joseph Cotton to be like, take him away, boys.
It's so good. Her performance is tremendous. She does win the Oscar for this. Again, I think pacing, the two things about this movie that I like the most, I mean, the cinematography is great, but I love the writing and I love the pacing of the acting. I think it's really well directed. And I think Bergman, especially in the ending, but throughout, like it's so earned. It's not just that you're mad at Charles Boyer. It's that you've gone through this suffering with Ingrid Bergman. It's so uncomfortable to watch. And if you've managed to get this far, You don't. It would be very unsatisfying, even if when he's tied up in the chair, if Joseph Cotton had just brought in reinforcements and they had taken him away, that would be like, okay, well, it's over. But you need what Ingrid Bergman is able to do in that moment, taking back her power. You need that to sort of leave the movie feeling a little less clenched up inside.
And I like that Cotton like doesn't sweep her into his arms and say, baby, you're mine now, and kiss her. Instead, he's just like, hey, you've been through a really rough time. I respect and appreciate that. Is it okay if I come back and just talk to you some more and maybe we can become friends? And she's like, yeah, I'd like that. And that's just lovely.
He underplays nicely. Like, despite what we said about the stalky tactic, he I feel like, and Cotton is not a ham actor by any means, but he can play a little heavier or a little you know, more intense than he does here. And so I think that's, and I think it's to the credit of the character that he's not only doing that when he's in that scene of with Bergman where he's trying to become her friend after the story is over, but just in general, like he's a cop who's in society as well, I guess. I don't really understand. A gentleman cop, maybe that's what we should call him. Mm-hmm. And he understands his role in the movie. He knows he's not the star of the movie. I can't help but think that this is the same year he made Shadow of a Doubt. So, you know, if you want to see Joseph Cotton being a different sort of a person, that would be the movie for you to see.
Very good movie.
Highly yeah, he's actually the assist.
Yes.
He's the assistant of, I don't know what the guy is, if he's the chief or whatever. So he's not just a cop. He's not just a detective. He's actually like the right-hand man of somebody who has a decent amount of power. So it makes sense to me that he is in society and, you know, is rubbing elbows with the lady who's giving the party in the first place. So and also, like, the fact that he is a cop makes it, to me, a little bit less creepy stalkery because, I mean, just maybe just based on the movies with cops in them that I've seen from this era, like, they had a lot more leeway to just kind of do whatever they wanted, at least in movies. So the idea that you would just, you know, randomly reassign the beat cop to your own advantage and have them spy for you just seems like a natural thing that a cop would do in those days in the movies. So it's looking at it from a today perspective, yeah, that's creepy and overreach and overstepping. But looking at it in the context of other movies that I've seen from the 1940s, it's definitely more leaning on the heroic side, I think.
I love the beat cop and his grin and his comment of like, you know, the things I do for the force, sir.
But I think you also need him in the story because he's what's sort of revealing the mystery, because we aren't getting that story from within the house because everything's just being shut down and contained. So he is out investigating for us and revealing like, oh, this is what happened in, you know, in this is what he's probably looking for. And this is what's probably, and he, you know, figuring out where Charles Boyer is going every night and all those pieces, and talking to the nosy neighbor and kind of putting together the backstory and what's happening. So, you know, he's our mystery solver and our professional sleuth that we need to drive that angle of the story forward.
And having the cop in addition, the beat cop and then Angela Lansbury and the cook, this movie can be and is very claustrophobic, not only because of the number of characters, but just because of the way Boyer is treating Bergman. And I think every additional character you can have, whether you're inside the house or outside the house, helps to release a little bit of tension. And it's not comic relief in the sense that a lot of times you'll have a drama where you've got some goofy character that doesn't seem to fit, because they're entertaining characters and they're doing something much more easy to view than what's happening with the main characters, but they're not, you know, goofballs just placed in the wrong
movie. What about Dame May Whitty?
Oh, well, that's true. I forgot about her.
She's like the straight-up comic relief. She accomplishes nothing for the plot except, like, to bring up the backstory at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah. She kind of gets on my nerves, to be honest. I generally like her, mm-hmm. but I in this movie, I see the point of her being there. You're right. Never mind about what I said about the not being there comic. I can edit myself, can I?
There's a better version of this movie where she and Joseph Cotton team up and work together, and she's like, yeah, I'm worried about that girl. And she's not just like, oh, well, murder, I'm so interested. My life is so boring.
Right, and he gets her to watch out her front window every night, and she kind of watches where Charles Boyer goes or something like that. I don't know. And she's excited to be involved. At first, she's like not sure how to take this, and then all of a sudden, she's very conspiratorial, and she has ideas for him, and he's like, okay, that's enough, lady, that's enough.
Yes, that would be...
she could have gone full Miss Marple with him.
That's true.
But then...
or Jessica Fletcher.
Yeah, exactly.
But on the other hand, it does add to that claustrophobic, suffocating feeling where person after person after person is set up as someone who could help and then fails to. And Joseph Cotton is the only one dangling sometimes by the thinnest of threads who might still have a chance to help her. So I get it.
And I have not seen any of the earlier versions of this, so I don't know. But it seemed to me like she was not in the movie as much as I sort of expected her to be. I thought she was going to pop up, like after the first time, I thought she was going to pop up more often and be more of a nosy busybody. And I just wonder if they took away some of her lines or scenes to give Angela Lansbury more to do.
Okay by me. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So
I'm good with
another it. Angela Lansbury trivia. She and Ingrid Bergman are the same height, but they put Angela Lansbury in heels so that she would tower over her. I love that. And I imagine that to be something that would happen after they beefed her parole, because they probably wouldn't even have thought about it. She's the maid. She's going to throw some saucy looks around, and then all of a sudden they're like, we're going to make this part bigger. Here's some heels, Angela.
Mm-hmm. Stand tall, sister.
Yeah, I cannot emphasize it's really disturbing to hear Mrs. Potts's voice coming out of this incredibly sexy, smoldering lady, especially even if you've seen The Manchurian Candidate still.
I was going to say, I was thinking more Manchurian Candidate, honestly, but...
Even if you've seen The Manchurian Candidate still, this movie is just like, whoa. Jessica Fletcher, more like Jessica Rabbit.
Right, watch this after a Murder, She Wrote rewatch.
I'm going to tell you, like, sometimes Jessica wears a lot of really fancy gowns and stuff, and she is a very beautiful woman.
I think she is masked in
the fashion that she wears of the 80s is, like, great. And I'm going to defend. She is, even in Murder, She Wrote, she's still a hot woman.
I honestly feel like that show is kind of underrated. It probably went on more years than I wouldn't have watched it in every single season. But I feel like I could watch a Murder, She Wrote. I could
totally
do that.
It's super formulaic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but
of course.
She's great. She is amazing. And she never needs rescuing. So,
no.
You know,
and if you are an old movie nerd, as am I, you will occasionally see her contemporaries popping up. Sometimes as sweet little weird old men and sometimes as dastardly killers. Which is fun. Well, friends, thank you so much for joining me to talk about Gaslight. And it is worth mentioning, as we did earlier, that this could be a triggering film for some people. It's somewhat uncomfortable to watch, especially if you've had experiences in romantic relationships where people have engaged in psychological abuse. And that should absolutely be taken into account. But if it's a movie that you feel like you're up to watching, it is well worth your time. The performances are great. The directing is great. We all really enjoyed it. So thank you, Nathan, Annette, and Erica, for joining me. And we'll be back in 2 weeks to watch The Narrow Margin. In the meantime, you can follow us over on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. You can find us at theincomparable.com/LTS, where you could also become a member of the Incomparable Network and support all the great shows we do. Or if you like us best, as you should, you can support Lions, Towers, and Shields specifically. We'll be back in 2 weeks to talk about The Narrow Margin, a film noir from 1953 that takes place on a train. Bye now.